This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Clouds so swift, the rain won't live. Gate won't close, the railings froze. Get your minds off winter time. You ain't going nowhere. Ooh-wee, red knee-high. Tomorrow's the day my bride's gonna come. Whoa, we gonna fly down in the easy chair.
Hi, Laura Hurwitz here. And welcome to the Easy Chair. Today I have a pre-teaching episode for you. The book I'm using this year to teach my writing students is called Bird by Bird, and it's by an extraordinary author named Anne Lamott. She is funny, she's a little profane, she is just the wittiest and warmest writer, and I think she's also just about the most honest. I think the way she approaches writing is kind of the way I approach writing, although I've never been able to put it into words. Every time I talk about Anne Lamott with another writer, they look at me and they say, "Shitty first drafts, right?" And shitty first drafts are something she has been known to advocate. I also am a fan of shitty first drafts. She has a lot of really great advice in this book, Bird by Bird, which I highly recommend. I hope you enjoy these two essays. I think they're pretty fabulous. The first one is called Short Assignments. The first useful concept is the idea of short assignments. Often when you sit down to write, what you have in mind is an autobiographical novel about your childhood, or a play about the immigrant experience, or a history of, say, women. But this is like trying to scale a glacier. It's hard to get your footing, and your fingertips get all red and frozen and torn up. Then your mental illnesses arrive at the desk like your sickest, most secretive relatives, and they pull up chairs in a semicircle around the computer, and they try to be quiet, but you know they are there with their weird, coppery breath, leering at you behind your back. What I do at this point, as the panic mounts and the jungle drums begin beating, and I realize that the well has run dry, and that my future is behind me, and that I'm going to have to get a job, only I'm completely unemployable, is to stop. First, I try to breathe, because I'm either sitting there panting like a lapdog, or I'm unintentionally making slow, asthmatic death rattles. So I just sit there a minute, breathing slowly, quietly. I let my mind wander. After a moment, I may notice that I'm trying to decide whether or not I'm too old for orthodontia, and whether right now might be a good time to make a few calls. And then I start to think about learning to use makeup, or how maybe I could find some boyfriend who's not a total and complete fixer-upper, and then my life would be totally great and I'd be happy all the time. And then I think about all the people I should have called back before I sat down to work, and how I should probably at least check in with my agent and tell him this great idea I have, and see if he thinks I need orthodontia, if that is what he's actually thinking whenever we have lunch together. Then I think about someone I'm really annoyed with, or some financial problem that is driving me crazy, and decide that I must resolve this before I get down to today's work. So, I become a dog with a chew toy, worrying it for a while, wrestling it to the ground, flinging it over my shoulder, chasing it, licking it, chewing it, flinging it back and forth over my shoulder. I stop just short of actually barking. But all of this takes only somewhere between 1 and 2 minutes, so I haven't actually wasted that much time. Still, it leaves me winded. I go back to trying to breathe, slowly and calmly, and I finally notice the 1-inch picture frame that I put on my desk to remind me of short assignments. It reminds me that all I have to do is write down as much as I can see through a 1-inch picture frame. This is all I have to bite off for the time being. All I'm going to do right now, for example, is write that one paragraph that sets the story in my hometown in the late 50s, when the trains were still running. I'm going to paint a picture of it in words on my computer. Or all I'm going to do is describe the main character the very first time we meet her, when she first walks out the front door and onto the porch. I'm not even going to describe the expression on her face when she first notices the blind dog sitting behind the wheel of her car. Just what I can see through the 1-inch picture frame, just one paragraph describing this woman in the town where I grew up, the first time we encounter her. E.L. Doctorow once said that writing a novel is like driving a car at night. You can see only as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way. You don't have to see where you're going. You don't have to see your destination or everything you will pass along the way. You just have to see 2 or 3 feet ahead of you. This is right up there with the best advice about writing or life that I've ever heard. So, after I've completely exhausted myself thinking about the people I most resent in the world and my more arresting financial problems, and of course, the orthodontia, I remember to pick up the 1-inch picture frame and to figure out a 1-inch piece of my story to tell, one small scene, one memory, one exchange. I also remember a story that I know I've told elsewhere, but that over and over helps me to get a grip. 30 years ago, my older brother, who was 10 years old at the time, was trying to get a report on birds written that he'd had 3 months to write and which was due the next day. We were out at our family cabin in Bolinas, and he was at the kitchen table, close to tears, surrounded by binder paper and pencils and unopened books on birds, immobilized by the hugeness of the task ahead. Then my father sat down beside him, put his arm around my brother's shoulder, and said, "Bird by bird, buddy. Just take it bird by bird." I tell this story again because it usually makes a dent in the tremendous sense of being overwhelmed that my students experience. Sometimes it actually gives them hope. And hope, as Chesterton said, is the power of being cheerful in circumstances that we know to be desperate. Writing can be a pretty desperate endeavor because it is about some of our deepest needs, our need to be visible, to be heard, our need to make sense of our lives, to wake up and grow and belong. It is no wonder we sometimes tend to take ourselves a bit too seriously. So here's another story I tell often. In the Bill Murray movie Stripes, in which he joins the army, there's a scene that takes place the first night of boot camp, where Murray's platoon is assembled in the barracks. They are supposed to be getting to know their sergeant, played by Warren Oates, and one another. So each man takes a few moments to say a few things about who he is and where he's from. Finally, it is the turn of this incredibly intense, angry guy named Francis. "My name is Francis," he says. "No one calls me Francis. Anyone here calls me Francis and I'll kill them. Another thing, I don't like to be touched. Anyone here ever tries to touch me, I'll kill them." At which point, Warren Oates jumps in and says, "Hey, lighten up, Francis." This is not a bad line to have taped to the wall of your office. Say to yourself, in the kindest way possible, "Look, honey, all we're going to do for now is to write a description of the river at sunrise, or the young child swimming in the pool at the club, or the first time the man sees the woman he will marry. That is all we're going to do for now. We're just going to take this bird by bird, but we are going to finish this one short assignment." I'm going to jump in here with a word from this week's sponsor, Rothy's Shoes. Rothy's has grown to a most loved, gotta have 'em brand. It's no surprise that they have over 1,000 nearly perfect reviews. Rothy's are everyday flats for life on the go. They're stylish, they're versatile, and they go with everything from yoga pants to dresses and skirts. I'm going to a wedding this week, and I'm wearing Rothy's. The black flats go with everything. Another major bonus, Rothy's are fully machine washable. Every time they need a refresh, you simply toss them in the washing machine, and it's like getting a fresh pair every laundry day. Rothy's are manufactured in a zero-waste factory, and they ship directly in the shoebox, so there's no unnecessary packaging. These are feel-good flats in more ways than one. So, go to rothys.com, that's rothys.com/chair, to get your new favorite flats. Comfort, style, and sustainability. These are the shoes you've been waiting for. Head to rothys.com/chair today. And now, back to the podcast. Okay, so that was the first essay. The second essay is the one that people often talk to me about, which is shitty first drafts. Now, practically better news than that of short assignments is the idea of shitty first drafts. All good writers write them. That is how they end up with good second drafts and terrific third drafts. People tend to look at successful writers, writers who are getting their books published and maybe even doing well financially, and think that they sit down at their desks every morning feeling like $1 million, feeling great about who they are and how much talent they have and what a great story they have to tell. That they take a few deep breaths, push back their sleeves, roll their necks a few times to get all the cricks out, and dive in, typing fully formed passages as fast as a court reporter. But that is just the fantasy of the uninitiated. I know some very great writers, writers you love who write beautifully and have made a great deal of money, and not one of them sits down routinely feeling wildly enthusiastic and confident. Not one of them writes elegant, fine first drafts. All right, one of them does, but we do not like her very much. We do not think she has a rich inner life or that God likes her or can even stand her. Although when I mentioned this to my priest friend Tom, he said that you can safely assume you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people you do. Very few writers really know what they are doing until they've done it. Nor do they go about their business feeling dewy and thrilled. They do not type a few stiff warm-up sentences, then find themselves bounding along like huskies across the snow. One writer I know tells me that he sits down every morning and says to himself nicely, "It's not like you don't have a choice, because you do. You can either type or kill yourself." We all often feel like we are pulling teeth. Even those writers whose prose ends up being the most natural and fluid. The right words and sentences just do not come pouring out like ticker tape most of the time. Now, Muriel Spark is said to have felt that she was taking dictation from God every morning, sitting there, one supposes, plugged into a dictaphone, typing away and humming. But this is a very hostile and aggressive position. One might hope for bad things to rain down on a person like this. For me, and for most of the other writers I know, writing is not rapturous. In fact, the only way I can get anything written at all is to write really, really shitty first drafts. The first draft is the child's draft, where you let it all pour out and then let it romp all over the place, knowing that no one is going to see it and you can shape it later. You can just let this childlike part of you channel whatever voices and visions come through and onto the page. If one of the characters wants to say, "Well, so what, Mr. Poopy Pants?" you let her. No one's going to see it. If the kid wants you to get into really sentimental, weepy, emotional territory, you let him. Just get it all down on paper, because there may be something great in those six crazy pages that you would never have gotten to by more rational, grown-up means. There may be something the very last line of the very last paragraph on page six that you just love, that is so beautiful or wild, that now you know what you're supposed to be writing about, more or less, or in what direction you might go. But there was no way to get to this without first getting through the first 5.5 pages. I used to write food reviews for California Magazine before it folded. My writing food reviews had nothing to do with the magazine folding, although every single review did cause a couple of canceled subscriptions. Some readers took umbrage at my comparing mounds of vegetable puree with various ex-presidents' brains. These reviews always took 2 days to write. First, I'd go to a restaurant several times with a few opinionated, articulate friends in tow. I'd sit there writing down everything anyone said that was at all interesting or funny. Then, on the following Monday, I'd sit down at my desk with my notes and I'd try to write the review. Even after I'd been doing this for years, panic would set in. I'd try to write a lead, but instead I'd write a couple of dreadful sentences. Cross them out, try again, cross everything out, and then feel despair and worry settle on my chest like an X-ray apron. "It's over," I'd think calmly. "I'm not going to be able to get the magic to work this time. I'm ruined. I'm through. I'm toast. Maybe," I'd think, "I can get my old job back as a clerk typist, but probably not." I'd get up and study my teeth in the mirror for a while. Then I'd stop, remember to breathe, make a few phone calls, hit the kitchen, and chow down. Eventually, I'd go back and sit down at my desk, sigh for the next 10 minutes, pick up the 1-inch picture frame, stare into it as if for an answer, and every time the answer would come, all I had to do was write a really shitty first draft of, say, the opening paragraph. And no one was going to see it. So I'd start writing without reining myself in. It was almost just typing, making my fingers move, and the writing would be terrible. I'd write a lead paragraph that was a whole page, even though the entire review could only be 3 pages long, and then I'd start writing up descriptions of the food, one dish at a time, bird by bird, and the critics would be sitting on my shoulder, commenting like cartoon characters. They'd be pretending to snore or rolling their eyes at my overwrought descriptions, no matter how hard I tried to tone those descriptions down, no matter how conscious I was of what a friend said to me gently in my early days of restaurant reviewing. "Annie," she said, "it's just a piece of chicken." But because I'd been writing for so long, I would eventually let myself trust the process, sort of, more or less. I'd write a first draft that was maybe twice as long as it should be, with a self-indulgent and boring beginning, stupefying description of the meal, lots of quotes from my black-humored friends that made them sound more like the Manson girls than food lovers, and no ending to speak of. The whole thing would be so long and incoherent and hideous that for the rest of the day, I'd obsess about getting creamed by a car before I could write a decent second draft. I'd worry that people would read what I'd written and believe that the accident had really been a suicide, and that I'd panicked because my talent was waning and my mind was shot. The next day, though, I'd sit down, go through it all with a colored pen, take out everything I possibly could, find a new lead somewhere on the second page, figure out a kicky place to end it, then write a second draft. It always turned out fine, sometimes even funny and weird and helpful. I'd go over it one more time and mail it in. Then, a month later, when it was time for another review, the whole process would start again, complete with the fears that people would find my first draft before I could rewrite it. Almost all good writing begins with terrible first efforts. You need to start somewhere. Start by getting something, anything, down on paper. A friend of mine says that the first draft is the down draft. You just get it down. The second draft is the up draft. You fix it up. You try to say what you have to say more accurately. And the third draft is the dental draft, where you check every tooth to see if it's loose or cramped or decayed, or even, God help us, healthy. What I've learned to do when I sit down to work on a shitty first draft is to quiet the voices in my head. First, there's the vinegar-lipped reader lady who says primly, "Well, that's not very interesting, is it?" Then there's the emaciated German male who writes these Orwellian memos detailing your thought crimes. Then there are your parents, agonizing over your lack of loyalty and discretion. And then there's William Burroughs, dozing off or shooting up because he finds you as bold and articulate as a houseplant. And so on. And then there are also the dogs. Let's not forget the dogs. The dogs in their pen who will surely hurtle and snarl their way out if you ever stop writing, because writing is, for some of us, the latch that keeps the door of the pen closed, keeps those crazy, ravenous dogs contained. Quieting these voices is at least half the battle I fight daily, but this is better than it used to be. It used to be 87%. Left to its own devices, my mind spends much of its time having conversations with people who aren't there. I walk along defending myself to people, or exchanging repartee with them, or rationalizing my behavior, or seducing them with gossip, or pretending I'm on their TV talk show or whatever. I speed or run an aging yellow light, or don't come to a full stop, and one nanosecond later I'm explaining to imaginary cops exactly why I had to do what I did, or insisting that I did not, in fact, do it at all. I happened to mention this to a hypnotist I saw many years ago, and he looked at me very nicely. At first I thought he was feeling around on the floor for the silent alarm button, but then he gave me the following exercise, which I still use to this day. Close your eyes and get quiet for a minute, until the chatter starts up. Then isolate one of the voices and imagine the person speaking as a mouse. Pick it up by the tail and drop it into a mason jar. Then isolate another voice, pick it up by the tail, drop it in the jar. And so on. Drop in any high-maintenance parental units. Drop in any contractors, lawyers, colleagues, children, anyone who is whining in your head. Then put the lid on and watch all these mouse people clawing at the glass, jabbering away, trying to make you feel like shit because you won't do what they want. You won't give them more money, you won't be more successful, you won't see them more often. Then imagine there's a volume control button on the bottle. Turn it all the way up for a minute and listen to this stream of angry, neglected, guilt-mongering voices. Then turn it all the way down and watch the frantic mice lunge at the glass, trying to get to you. Leave it down and get back to your shitty first draft. A writer friend of mine suggests opening the jar and shooting them all in the head, but I think he's a little angry. And I'm sure nothing like this would ever occur to you. Okay, so those are those two essays by Anne Lamott. Love them. Can't wait to teach them. And I hope you enjoyed her observations, because they're not only good for writing, they really are good for life in general. So until next time, this is Laura Hurwitz from The Easy Chair. Have a great week. See ya.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.